John Gooden, thank you for joining me, my friend. Look, I wanted to connect with you because I've been doing commentary, play-by-play commentary for a couple of years now. And it's something that I'll be honest with you, if you asked me 10 years ago what a commentator does, it would have probably been, oh, well, they just sit there and they talk about the fight and they say some moves and they do whatever. But since I've kind of jumped into the sphere, my appreciation for it has grown infinitely. And someone like yourself who is, you know, working at such a level with the UFC, you're really repping the Brit guys over there. I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to get a feel for how you got to where you are and just how you approach it, because I think there's so many different ways. I don't know if there's anything called a commentary school, how people teach you to formally do it. So I think everyone's method to this madness is a little bit different. But look, before we get to the nuts and bolts of things, let's talk about you, all right? Where was John Gooden born? What were your aspirations as a kid?
I was born, first of all, thank you for that lovely intro. And can I just say, this is going to sound really weird, but I'm really happy for you, man. I'm kind of proud that you made this transition to commentary, because I do remember you mentioning wrestling and commentary to me a long, long time ago. And when I saw you appear on the screen doing a WWE, I'm like, he went after it. I know that people say this to me, because like 10 years ago, I'm sure we get to that part of my journey, but I went after it. And if you go after it and you stick to it and you do what's necessary and you completely throw yourself into these things, then a little bit of luck, right place, right time, do all the necessary bits and pieces the universe delivers. So first, you know, I just wanted to get that out of the way as well while we're stroking each other's egos. and then, I was born in Edgware, which is kind of North London, if you like. And growing up, I moved from like Harrow Weald to Edgware to then a place called Radlett, which is in Hertfordshire, where I was and grew up for many, many years. Worked in the city and the BBC for a short while. I lived in West Hampstead in London and then went back home, bounced around a bit, stayed around the Watford area, still in the area now. But growing up, my aspirations were all over the place, I think. I thought I was going to be in the financial markets. I wanted to be a stockbroker. I can remember that quite vividly. I also wanted to be a racing driver. I still harbour intentions of one day doing a season. It's just too much money. It's a very expensive sport, but racing driving was something that I was looking at. And then when I was in the city, in the financial markets, but not the side of it that I really wanted to be on, I had this overwhelming desire to become a TV presenter. I just felt like with all of the conversations that I was having, the meetings, etc., people would say, oh, you're some silver tongue guy and you're quite captivating, those sorts of things. And, you know, I was a single man at the time as well, Andy, and I was putting those notes to good use as well. So my confidence was like sky high. And I was looking at Vernon Kay and Dermot O'Leary, who I think they're like, certainly Dermot now is just the gold standard. But back in the day, he was learning his craft, and we know what that's like. It's reps which make you good. And I thought I could do that. So I actually jacked in my job in the city and tried to do the whole TV thing, like giving my services for free on various different broadcasts at the BBC. Got taken in for a little while, but it was all behind the camera and the opportunities that I was looking at. Do you remember Angelica Bell?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of penciled to do like a show with her, but then the whole channel, BBC Three, all changed up, and with it went the opportunities, and with that went my rented property in London. I was back home with the parents, and that confidence was just, and I'm riding around a moped earning like 14 grand a year after earning 36, 37 grand in the city, you know, because it was financial markets. And I was just like, this is, don't think I can do this. So pretty much it's like, nah, not going to happen. And I was all
when
right.
You were saying you want to be a TV presenter, was it that kind of Dermot O'Leary sphere you were going into? Was sports out of the mix this time? Was it, Dermot O'Leary or Steve Jones?
Yeah, BLE, stuff like light entertainment, or even, weirdly, like business. So I was speaking with the business and economics unit at the BBC and seeing if there was anything there. You'll laugh at this one. Do you remember Roger Cook, the Cook Report? Like consumer affairs stuff, like Watchdog.
So yeah.
And they were trying to see if they could mold me into like an investigative journalist, where you'd have to look over your shoulder for the rest of your days, because you're basically turning in anyone that's dodgy by scoping them out and stuff.
You could never walk down a dark alley by yourself again.
Exactly. So I was kind of said no to that, but there exists a screen test with me like doorstepping someone. It was all mocked, like in the car park at the BBC. And I just made such a hash of it for what they wanted. But they were kind of looking at me in that role because I was there for a little while and I had a different approach. I was a bit older than the typical media student that would crash through the gates of White City. But it wasn't where I wanted to be. So I left it behind. But yes, the light entertainment side was where I thought that I would enjoy myself more.
But it sounds even in those early days, you'd made some good inroads to be sort of considered for shows and to be having, even if they fell by the wayside, to be in that mix. It sounded like you were in there deep.
No, I wouldn't say deep. I think the one thing that has always served me well is if you're nice to people, if you help people out, if you're not a dick, then over a little bit of time, you earn some credit. And someone in a fairly influential position might just go, he's all right. Look, here's a bone. And you then get that conversation. You might get a screen test or something like that. So I wasn't getting this on talent. I was getting this because I was knocking around the halls of TVC and White City, and people maybe liked me because I've always had a really strong work ethic. So whatever I did, I'd work super hard, I'd be in, I wouldn't complain, and I enjoyed it because it was new at the time. So that enthusiasm kind of, I think generally anyone that's really passionate or enthusiastic about something, there's a magnetism around that. So I think I had that going for me, but that was disappearing, mate, because I didn't ultimately want to be doing Watchdog for the rest of my life and watching Nicky Campbell have him take the piss out of me and some of these other, Nick, who's the guy that did DIY SOS, he was around as well, didn't really like him. But, other, you know, it's Nick Knowles, that's the guy. He tried to steal my girlfriend from me. And it's just, you know, I'm like...
He's probably... You're not the first, mate. You're probably not the first.
I 100% know, wasn't it? Because he was seeing Susie Perry at the time. And some of the stories that were flying around.
Susie Perry wasn't enough for him?
There you go. So, yeah, didn't really like that fella. There you go. That's a couple of rumours from the inside.
So with that, was there a point then that you know, even though you were in the mix, it would seem, was there a point where you were like, I'm out? Was there a nail in the proverbial coffin?
Yeah, because I've always been super ambitious. And my mum was... very pretentious. She grew up not having anything, nothing at all. Like they used to cut the ends off their shoes when their feet got too big for them. Like that side of the family, it's very complicated, but yeah, they didn't have a lot. And then on the other side, my granddad was a chimney sweep and a postman. Like he'd be pulling 2-3 jobs to make ends meet for his family. And my dad's got a ridiculous work ethic. To the day, I don't have the energy that my dad has. He still works 7 days a week on the tools as an electrician. And I always had this thing about business. I genuinely enjoyed it. I did business at uni. I wanted to create something, read all the books, listened to all the stuff, got seduced by the films. And I just had an inclination for that. So that turned my attention. I wanted the money. I knew what that meant after being in the city. I knew what it meant. I tried to go back to the city as well, but the IT bubble had burst. So I ended up just joining my dad's company. I went back to college with the kids to retrain as an electrician and then ended up, you know, trying like elevating my dad's business to the next level. But it was hard. It was the family business. So again, there was a part of my heart that was really into it. But my dad and I used to fight day and night, and we're best friends, but it never really crossed over. But at the same time, it's just not comfortable. And the money wasn't really there. You know, it wasn't like I was suddenly killing it with a 6-figure salary. I was still working really hard for what I had. And then the MMA thing came about and it turned my head. And as we know, it's obviously now taken over for me. So it's, yeah, I've done a lot of stuff. And I think that gives me quite a difference to a lot of other people that are in my position, our position in TV, be it in front or behind the camera.
Yeah, I think, also I think because of the varied background you've had, you know what it's like to work outside the TV bubble. And I think often that can give you an appreciation for the business and for what, you know, we're so lucky to get to do. Let's rewind just a little bit, because we're going to obviously come to sport. What's the first memory of sport that evokes anything in your mind? Was it a moment in your youth or your teenage years of sport that touched you and made you think, this is pretty cool?
Yeah, I've always been a really competitive sports person. So I've always enjoyed the participation a little bit more than the spectating, which is weird given the role that I'm in. But maybe that's why you still see me with black eyes and, you know, twisted limbs, etc., because I just can't stay away from it. So swimming was something that got me first. I was like a standout swimmer when I was young. Like 5 or 6, I was doing all that stuff, like swimming galas every weekend, etc. Started having a bit of success at that. And judo. I was doing, like, competing nationally in judo as well. So that was something that, you know, you derive a lot of satisfaction from that. And then obviously, like all young kids, you get involved. A lot of those things, by the way, are very individual sports, right? And football in our part of the world is so big. I would then connect with a lot of my friends around football and, you know, win stuff, school things. And they were really the things in terms of participation. In terms of watching boxing and football itself, more probably from memory, your national team sports like England football, but boxing, Barry McGuigan, Eubank, Prince Nazim a little bit later, Bruno, Lennox, you know, yes. So those kind of guys. My dad's a big boxing fan. So that's what comes to mind.
So sports always been sort of in your life in some way. So let's talk about that transition then. So you're working, from what I believe, for your father, and then you found yourself in the MMA mix. How did you go from being in the world of, let's say, combat sports to being the person who was calling the fights?
Yeah, so I'd obviously had this martial arts thing when I was younger. It went from judo to karate, karate to boxing, doing like the novice ABA stuff. But as I previously mentioned, it was all very individual and none of my friends were into it. I did all of this by myself with no mate who really wanted to fight. So I missed my mates and it was a little bit tough. And again, I was never great at these things. I did boxing when I was at uni. So really the focus was uni, not like boxing. And I was 19. I'm never going to make a pro at that stage. I didn't really harbour the intentions. I just, you know, the girls liked it. Where I lived in the provincial areas of London, you know, the tough man reputation thing held some weight. So it kind of helped out socially rather than, but I also got enjoyment from it, of course. So, it was a bit weird, but I went back to football and started playing football at a fairly decent level because whatever I do, I just throw myself into it and I've always been quite athletic. But it just came back, like in my late 20s, it just came back and I wanted to start back in martial arts. And by that point, I'd recognised the UFC and mixed martial arts, wanted to find that, but I didn't know where. It wasn't like it is now. There weren't black belts on every corner. It was a long way from there. So I ended up going down to London Fight Factory, trying a bit of jiu-jitsu, and then I'd stick around for the Muay Thai class. Then from him, my crew, he would say, well, what about there's a closer school to where you live, if I'm honest, mate. So I'd do that. And eventually I found myself with a guy called Mark Chen, who was under Jess Lowder, who fought in the UFC. He was in Harrow. Denison Sutherland, who's become one of my closest friends over the years, he was there as well. And a bunch of guys who I still train with. When Mark went up north, I ended up joining Dave Lee. And at this time, I'm learning, right? I'm trying to put it together. I wanted to fight and compete. But again, there was no amateur scene, really. You had the combat sports trials and then semi-pro and then pro. And I actually did have a semi-pro fight scheduled, and then I got bursitis on my knee and it started a whole bunch of injury problems. But the one thing that struck me from mixed martial arts was how they didn't get the recognition that they deserved. The guys, my coaches and the other fighters, they weren't earning the money. No one really knew what they did. And it just didn't sit right. And then the guys...
At this point, when you're breaking into it, is it still the cage fighting days?
Yes, kind of course. You know, Yeah. I mean, we get to a point where this is even just before, like, Alex Reed. And he was... I've got nothing really against Alex Reed, but he's not the best spokesperson for the sport, I think. And we've moved past that. But he was the guy that we go to. He's the cage fighter that was dating Jordan. You know, it's like, do you know what mixed martial art is? Cage fighting? Alex Reed? Oh, yeah. You kind of have to go down the chain. So, yeah, it was a bit of a tough thing to watch. And then you had one program on Sky Sports, which was trying to represent it. And it just did it in all the ways that I didn't agree with for promoting martial arts, the martial arts code and things like that. It was blood, birds, knockouts. And, like, it was just all sensationalist rubbish. And I looked at all of this and I started getting a bit twitchy, thinking, I really want to try and help. And I would do a little bit of writing for some MMA media sites. And I remember going to, like, a Bama gig once and writing a report up on that. That was really cool. Couldn't believe my luck.
And was the Bama one the Alex Reed fight, by the way? That was my first MMA fight. That's when I first got into it.
And it was an epic fight. I think
that was an incredible fight. To this day, that was an incredible fight.
Yeah. A really, really good fight. I think it might have been. If it wasn't, I was definitely covering that fight, and I was there to see it. Tom Watson coming out in like the gorilla thing, and yeah, he had there's a bit of showmanship there as well. And around this time, my coach ended up taking over a local show in Watford. It was a show that I had aspirations of competing on myself, and it was a team show as well. So if I was like backstage helping fighters warm up, do a bit of cornering. And then he turned around to me once and, oh no, there was a girl that came down from LA Muscle TV. I don't know if you ever remember this TV. There was this really random like digital channel. And they were doing a backstage thing because Hayden Critchfield, one of my longtime training partners, had an LA Muscle sponsor. And this woman came down, and it's not her fault, but it again, just rubbed me up the wrong way. She didn't know the sport. She made a really bad job of representing it. She kind of made a mockery of it because she was a bit uncomfortable. But everyone was just so pleased to see a camera at an MMA show, right? It was just...
Someone cares about us. Someone wants to see this.
Exactly.
Channel 7000 on Sky, but we're going to see it.
Exactly. And I latched on to Coach and said, look, Dave, can I do that? Next one, let me do that. And he said, well, I have no hold over LA Muscle TV. He says, but we could do some commentary, throw a couple of cameras up over the cage, and then we can give them a DVD of their performances and kind of they can look back on it, and it helps, right? It's nice. It's a little memento as well as everything else. And the weird thing was, going back to when I was at the BBC, they used to have an apprenticeship scheme for wannabe commentators. And when I was there, having like some food in the canteen, I remember seeing that on the internal newspaper. I forgot what it's called, like a broadcast magazine type deal. And I completely rubbished the idea. I was like, no, I want to be a presenter because commentators aren't seen. Growing up, I couldn't tell you what some of my favourite commentators look like. Even to the day, the guys in the UK are rarely seen. And it wasn't about like this, but I just didn't connect with it as much. It seemed like the old guy that was a bit more geeky. For some reason, it really made sense. And maybe it's because I was watching the UFC product and those commentators, or us commentators, I can say now, we pull double duty. We're presenting and commentating. So it's quite a nice blend, although it puts a lot of pressure on the presenting side. So, yeah, I started doing some commentary. I really enjoyed it. And going back to what I said before, when I do something, I can't just play at it. I go all in. So before I know it, I'm driving around the home counties, visiting gyms where we have people coming up on the fight card, jumping on the mats with them, seeing how they felt, seeing what they were good about, you know, chewing the fat after the training session and bringing that to commentary for like a fight night at the Watford Coliseum with no one watching.
But let's talk about your first few commentary gigs, shall we say? Because the only thing is, when I first started exploring commentary, I'd been doing the TV presenting side for a while, and I kind of, you know, had a rough grip on that. But the commentary side of stuff, I listen back to now some of my, you know, I've got a bunch of demo reels that I was doing and just trying to learn from those. I had no idea. I had no idea how to construct a call. Just, and even the basic nuts and bolts of kind of what goes on there. So when you did your first call, your first few calls, looking back now with some more hindsight, do you think you had a decent grasp of it, or were you shouting moves?
I think I had something in my mind, and it all comes back to the fact of poor or misrepresentation of the sport. So for me, I wanted to tell the story so that it wasn't just fighter X versus fighter Y bashing the shit out of one another. I wanted you to care about those people. But the problem was back then, there's no YouTube. There's no Facebook where people are really putting stuff out. So I don't have anything on anyone that hasn't fought before. These might be first-time amateurs. So I'm now running around while people are getting their hands wrapped, going, okay, buddy, right, give me something. Because on the time when you burst through the curtain to the moment you get in the cage, I need to talk about something. And right now, I know you represent Premier MMA in, like, where at Uxbridge and who your coach is and what that might mean for your style. But I can't keep running that for the 50 fights that we had on that day, because that's also the thing. At the lower levels, you have a massive fight card and you're on the mic for 24 hours. So, yeah, I was just grabbing what I could and then trying to weave stories in and then, yeah, just trying to not be disrespectful to the athletes, try and be empathetic to their stage of the career, and also talk about the play-by-play, like what is going on and why things did or didn't work, maybe. Because I was on the mic by myself for my first few. No second person to bounce off. I used to do it on a dictaphone that big. I used to have it on a shelf. Is it there? No. I keep it around. It's honestly about that, so big. And I plugged a microphone into it to hold it, and that was it. And I did the first few shows.
Did you say almost those early gigs? Because obviously with UFC now, there's a swathe of information about all these fighters. You sometimes just got to go out and find it. When you're doing these earlier shows, not only are you yourself kind of learning your style, learning your flow, so to speak, but as you say, you know, you might go and talk to these guys for a minute or two and get one or two points you can throw in there. But I'm sure there's other times you couldn't get hold of them or there was nothing.
Yeah.
Is that almost harder at that level to call the fights than it is, in some respects, UFC?
No one's really watching, so it doesn't matter so much.
No one's hearing what you're saying, so...
Yeah, I mean, at the time it meant everything, right? It's the laws of relativity, because I was, you know, I was there in a position where that's what I was there to do. So I would then try and formulate patterns. Had we seen them before? Like, I might have been able to research that they'd fought somewhere. Where was that show? What did that mean? What was the finish? And I'd be guessing. But again, no one's calling you out. If you say, well, you know, finished by submission, little do we know that was the very first time he'd ever sunk a choke in his life. But if you said that at the UFC, you called someone a wrestler when they're a kickboxer, you'd be told about it by a good few thousand people. So, yeah, I don't know if it was easier or more difficult. But another thing that I used to do was construct questionnaires. I used to have a pro forma and I would fire off all these questionnaires and get people to answer. I still have one from Conor McGregor from when I did that. Yeah, I've got a cupboard full of notebooks, notes I've taken and from interviews.
Do you recall some of the stuff that Conor came back with back in those early days?
I've got some on my Facebook Messenger. I've still got some stuff from what Conor would say. And he's been really kind to me over the years. I feel like when in the early days, when we were coming through Cage Warriors, there was a kinship amongst people in the MMA community where we did want to see one another do well in whatever capacity we were, from the referees, judges, commentators, ring announcers, whatever it was, a stakeholder. For one, little side note, there was a rivalry going on between Cage Warriors and Bama, which you would have been privy to, but I fucking hated it.
Of course.
That. I hated
we
it.
Admit, you and me were on different sides of the fence on those days, different sides
I'm
of
like,
the fence.
Yeah, but like we're a tiny island. Yeah, we're trying to all push together. We got enough people pushing back on MMA, from the medical guys to, or, you know, local authorities. We don't need the
I always found that weird as well, because they're two similar size organizations. Also, the product they were putting out was a bit different. Bama were trying to run big arenas. You know, Cage Warriors were running a slightly different product.
Yeah.
But both the same kind of circle of fighters.
Needed
and it was
each
both
other.
Just grow. Yeah, it, and it's both just growing this nice community. So, again, you know, I was hosting Bama, and you'd always hear these, you know, these rivalry things, and it's like you're at school, you know, and it's like in the playground. Oh, so-and-so says you're an idiot. Oh, well, now I think they're an idiot. And it's back and forth that I don't really know how much rivalry there was apart from people saying there was, you know, because it's two products just giving people a platform to do great things.
Yeah, I think so. So that, that was a bit of a shame. But I sort of lost my way on where we were getting to with that. But
so you engage what Connor was helping you out, you know, people like Connor, everyone's supporting one another in terms of pushing themselves forward.
Sending out questionnaires and things. So yeah, that was my kind of information gathering process at the time.
So, you know, obviously you worked your way through the ranks, shall we say, of commentary in the UK. You found yourself with Cage Warriors, one of the premier organisations in the country. So you're working with those guys. Still, you've got your day job at this point. When did the transition, when did the call come? How did the call come from the UFC?
Yeah, it was kind of a weird time. Not many people know this, but Cage Warriors had let me go, essentially. I was doing Cage Warriors on holiday time. As I was saying, I was running a business with my dad. My dad worked 7 days a week. He expected me pretty much to do the same. And I would, you know, I was all in. It was the family. My name's essentially there, although it's my dad's business, if we share the same name. So I was really wanting to work hard there, trying to get ahead in life. But and I've got a girlfriend at the time, and maybe a fiance, and now my wife, and she wants my attention and to do things. And I was eating up all of my holiday time just calling fights for Cage Warriors, KO MMA, Shock and Awe, whoever it might have been. And sometimes I wasn't getting paid. Sometimes it was £50, £150. And I think the most I ever earned on a Cage Warriors show was £250. And I might have to fly to Dubai for 4 days for that. And people probably don't know that. And it's all okay, because that was the investment. That was my MBA, wasn't it? That I kind of invested, although I was probably deserved a bit more than that. It was a peppercorn token for your efforts. And I got to a point later in the year where I'm like, well, I have no more holiday to take. Please, can you just pay me what I would get on a Saturday if I was out working, so that at least when I go back to my wife, I can come back and say, well, I've been away, but this is the thing, so I can pay my bills. And they were like, yeah, no, thank you. We might call you next year. And it hurt, because I'd been with them a few years by this point. And Josh Palmer and I had got a really good thing going on. And we were, if I'd be so bold to say it, we were sort of synonymous with the brand a little bit. You had Joe Martinez, you had Ian Dean, the matchmaker, Graham Boylan leading the charge. And then Josh and I were sort of the voices that you would hear. So it did hurt. But by this point, I really enjoyed the work. I was looking at guys like you with envy. You know, I wanted to earn my living presenting stuff. I've got to go on a building site the next day and it's dreary. And I'm arguing with my dad and it's noisy and I'm breathing in dust and shit and my body's hurting. And I was just like, there's got to be a better life here. And people kept telling me that I was doing all right. But then I'd call up agents and things like that and no one would answer the call or give me a chance. So I was like, this isn't going to happen. Then someone close to me said, oh, it's all a pipe dream. Just throw the towel in. And I'm like, yeah, maybe you're right. And then my best mate, Willie B, turned around and said, don't you dare. You've done this for so long now. He says, you're so close. You've got to stick with it. Please stay with it. And I remember the building site that I was on as well. It was a friend of ours who had this building site who's done ever so well for himself as a house builder. And I'm out there kicking the rubble in my steel toe cap boots, listening to my mate Will with a tear coming down my eye, thinking I'm going to just leave it all behind. And yeah, he said, stay with it. And it prompted me to give a call to someone that used to work at Cage Warriors that then worked for the UFC. They told me that a new head honcho was coming into the European office. Perhaps she could organise a meeting, which she did. I got that meeting. I went with two sides of A4 of ideas. I didn't care what.
Are we talking about Amanda? Are we talking about Amanda here, by the way?
No, it wasn't. No, Amanda came later. And I met a guy called Gary Cook, who's a former chairman or CEO of Man City Football Club. So a real big swinging dick in like the sports world. And he took me out for dinner. Like, it was amazing. Like, I've never been taken out for a swanky dinner like this. And he was new, so I guess he was interested to hear different perspectives. And as I say, I had so many ideas, from merchandise to social media to TV programming and what could be done. And in the end, he said, oh, can I take that? And he took all my ideas from me. Because at the time I thought, well, what good are they to me if I'm not in there? So I'm not going to just hold on to them for what? So they can sit on my desk at home. So I gave him the ideas, and it was a little bit naughty, but kind of funny when I look back. I actually got offered a job from them to be the go-between for EA Sports and the UFC for the game. I was going to be like an intermediary. Gary Cook's like, well, let's get you off the sites. Let's get you involved. He had his arm around me, walked me to the elevator. I'll have your offer letter like in the post type thing. I'm still waiting for that offer letter to the day. It never came. Thank God I never quit my job. And then something happened where they were doing a UFC Manchester event. They needed a host for a Q&A. My name was still circulating around the office. They were going through expansion at the time. I got that gig. I then got offered a gig on BT Sport, which was hilarious looking back. No, it's still not hilarious. I still got PTSD over it. But I was doing a show covering that Manchester event with Caroline Pearce. And it was just the most unbelievable moment in my broadcasting career. I had death threats on the back of it. I had people just like losing their minds that we had dared go near the UFC product. I was so innocent walking into that one, Andy. I had no idea.
What was their problem? What was the problem with the show?
MMA fans and UFC fans are not one and the same. Like, there's a very small group of people that are MMA fans in this country. Most people are UFC fans, and they know nothing about the work that we've both done before we've gotten to where we are now. And they don't care to know about it. So when I rocked up in my velvet bow tie and my maroon jacket onto this wonderfully shiny, like, multi-million pound set at BT Sport, I'm like, I've made it, Mum, I've made it. And I'm sat next to Caroline Pearce, who's new as well. No one knew who she was. And I had all the comments like, this looks like a weird date. I wish your mum was... This is the best one. You're going to carry on laughing because now I appreciate this. I wish your mum would have swallowed. I like that one. I was like, boy, this is bad. And I'd never had any kind of...
They're not bashful, are they, MMA fans? They're not retiring.
No. I'd never really been big in the social media thing. So coming off of that, like, the most I'd got was like 40 notifications for a birthday before. Now I've got hundreds, but it's hate. And I was shaking. Physically shaking coming out there. We were told that we'd done a great broadcast. The producer then was like, this is great, fantastic work, really well done. I mean, looking back now, it was high level stuff what Caroline in particular was being asked. It's like newscaster stuff where you're taking live, you work into a live feed, taking it back in, turning it, like doing something, turning it back around and sending it out across a feed where you're not actually connected, you're laying over the UFC product. But they asked me to go in to read the rules and talk about the event at the end, to actually then talking through the walkouts, talking between rounds, talking as they're making the announcements. And you know how people are about their UFC product. I didn't know this was the way it was going to be. But yeah, I can see why there was a backlash, but some of it was a little unfair. So yeah, I thought I was done. I honestly thought that was it. So I tried to do some damage limitation with the UFC and explain my standpoint. But all the while, they didn't really care too much. They were trying to expand things. They started screen testing. They were looking for a commentator. And I went head-to-head with a very well-known breakfast DJ at the time. And I beat him to the post. Fortunately, the guys in Vegas didn't give a hoot about who he was. I knew the product. I did a screen test, very much molded to how they do their show. And it just looked closer. I worked well with Dan Hardy. And Robert's your father's brother. It's 2022 and I'm still here.
Amazing. Like, what an amazing journey. When you started calling the shows for UFC, how much input do you get from producers and so forth? Or are you left to your own devices in terms of your commentary?
There's two sides to that. There's the program side, which is the show structure. I know that you'll understand this, but perhaps other people might not. And to give you some perspective, I take in close to 200 pieces of paper for the show structure. And that's my cards, and they're being fed to me all the way through, and that chops and changes. And this is where the UFC is different. And we might come on to this. I mean, I'm going to start moaning now, Andy, because you're appreciate
it. Give me a moan.
I'll give you a moan. I don't think people in UK broadcasting power really do respect the work that's being done in the UFC. I don't know if there are many more difficult sports to produce and commentate on. It is high volume, unknown, marathon, Ironman type work. Football is 45 minutes a break, 45 minutes wrap. Not too many bits of promotional material.
And they get a toilet break.
Yeah. And I have to do a bleep test every month just to make sure I know I'm on point so I can get to the toilet and back, because I'm going to miss my lines. Someone else has to take over because it's a 6 or 7 hour broadcast with no breaks.
And how many toilet breaks? This is something that always intrigues me about your broadcast, because they are so long. How many times can you go for a wee during that 6-7 hours?
As few as possible. But I'll probably end up with, you've seen me already just talking to you. I've been sipping water. I'm a very
well hydrated man.
I am a thirsty broadcaster, but with that comes a very full bladder. And that means that I'm constantly pissing, and that's a problem. So I remember one time we got to the main event in Dublin. It was Paddy Houlihan who was in the main event. And I had to go during the commentary and leave Dan to the mic because we were going to be doing a stand up after. And at this point, I had my trousers already undone to relieve the pressure. And I said, if I'd stand up, I said, there's every chance I'm going to wet myself live. I said, so please, can I just go to the toilet? And I needed the toilet so bad, I was rearranging the room. You know, it's just the flow was just going. And I can hear Dan still commentating. I'm like, this isn't ending. It was horrendous. So when I, really
the broadcast that I do, we might do, they might be 4 hours, 3 to 4 hours in terms of how long I'm stationary for. So not quite the marathon endurance. I'm thirsty. I drink a lot of water, but I have to spend the day drinking water and then taper off into the evening. So that when it comes to broadcast time, and I literally have to monitor how much I'm drinking. And
water,
the worst is when you
broadcast.
100%. And the worst bit is when you start, let's say you've got 3.5 hours and you're at like 45 minutes in. And you start to feel a little, do I need a wee? And you probably don't need a wee. But it's in the back of your mind, like, hang on, I've still got 3 hours to go here. This is bad.
Yeah. And it's also eating. I mean, I'm all right with it now, but how many people go 6 or 7 hours without eating? And you don't want to fill yourself up before, because we all get pre-match nerves. And I don't really feel like it. And actually, I haven't got time to eat. I am still researching and getting my shit together until the moment we go on air. I could walk past a locker room and see someone in the corner crying or absolutely bouncing off the walls. And that means something for that person's commentary that I want to bring in because it's inside info. So, yeah, the longest one I did was on Fight Island. It was 9 hours. So what I was getting at is you'll write all of these scripts and you'll get everything in order. But if you did all of that, that 9 hours would actually be more like 11 hours. So they cut stuff out. A lot of those scripts go away. Then a fight goes short. It comes back in again. And it moves around and you're having constant traffic in your ear, which is something that not a lot of people can really deal with at first. So it's very challenging. And there aren't many other sports that do that. But we don't get the credit. Like, I don't even know if guys at Sky Sports and BT Sports even know who I am. Yet I think I have one of the toughest jobs in sports broadcasting, only because I've been told by guys in the UK that have done Champions League, the Olympics, F1, and they've said, sod that, that's mental, and you'll never do a harder job in broadcasting than what you're already doing. And I'm not really one for awards and such, but it would be nice if there was, again, much like the athletes don't get the credit, I don't think our producers and our on-screen, on-air talent get the credit for what we have to deal with.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd agree. In terms of your commentaries, I know with me with WWE, I've been helped a lot. From the moment that I kind of showed some interest in this to coming through, a lot of people have given me a lot of help and advice. In terms of my preparation, that's still something that every show I do, it evolves. I'm trying to learn what works for me and so forth. I like to write some things verbatim, and then I'm still working out, you know, some bullet points here, some questions, some this, that, the other. In terms of your prep, how has it evolved over the years? And is there anyone offering you feedback, advice, or is it very much a self-critical thing with you?
All of the above, and the evolution has been with the internet. Obviously, I now have access to all sorts of things, and like even Google Translate. I'm the international guy, right? So I'll be going over to China or Brazil, something like that. And I've got a card for the Brazilians. No one speaks English. No English speaking outlets are interviewing those guys. I'm not scared of that because, again, I go back to how I used to prepare grassroots level, which is different to someone who thinks they can jump in at the UFC end and has never called a fight before. Like, I'll always have an advantage. I'll always be able to find the story better than them because I've been down literally at ground zero. So we get there in the end, but I try and get ahead of the curve before I even get into fight week. I'm a couple of weeks, few weeks out. I'm constantly making notes from what I'm seeing on social media, screen capturing, clipping, voice notes, little phrases that I like, language that I'm reading. I log it all down. I keep it all in one place and I draw from that as and when is necessary. So that's one thing. I don't go back and watch my stuff as much as I used to, probably because I'm just a little bit too busy. And yeah, it's hard. Again, 7 hours. Like, and I don't like the sound of my own voice, believe it or not, as I'm rambling here. Like a heavy clip, but I find it quite uncomfortable. I know I get a feeling when I've done a bad show or a good show, and I don't know if I really want to be self-indulgent to go back, oh yes, that was a good line, or indeed go back and go, Jesus Christ, that was so bad. And
do you have a debrief with producers? Do they, you know, after the show, before show, they go, hey John, you could have done this differently, or maybe try this.
I go after it, and it's not just me, right? We're a team. So the producers might turn around and go, I'm really sorry. Like, this is what happened in the truck, which led to that. Because this is the other thing. You'll know this. And the American producers are super sensitive to this as well, way more than I think they are in the UK. But for the Americans, the talent is everything. And I don't even like the word talent, by the way. But like the on-screen and on-mic people that... they can't be wrong. And I'm like, of course we can be wrong. And you have every right. You're here before us and you leave after us. And we're trying to deliver your vision, essentially. I said, so no, you guys are the gods, but yet you don't get paid as much or treated as well. But they're like, oh, no. You guys all right? So you'll often get the stuff where they've sold you short on something and then you just look like a bit of a wally because you've spoken to the wrong graphic. It doesn't happen often. The guys at the UFC are elite. They are savants of the production game. But there's certain little bits. They might say, what the hell happened there? Like, you didn't give us a read for DraftKings, which happened not long ago. I'm like, but the comms cut out. Like, I had nothing, or I didn't get my card, or I don't know. I had a frog in my throat. I don't know what it might have been. So we do talk about these things. We have a drink after. We're a close team. I call every one of those guys in the truck a friend. People are very honest with me. I want the feedback. I want to be better. So I go in search of it. Doesn't hurt me necessarily. As I say, I'm a big boy. I know when I can do better. So it hurts me more when people over the years have just said, you're doing great. I'm like, well, I'm not on the TV as much as Dermot O'Leary. If we go back to him, I don't feel like I'm as smooth as a baby's bottom. There's all sorts of, how do I get there? You're doing great. I'm like, oh, well, I know I'm not. So please just.
Yeah. You need people to tell you, you know, what areas to work on. And I think just some of that can come from yourself and watching things back. And you, as you said, you know when something's not hit quite the mark. But someone just saying, yeah, you're doing great, isn't useful. It's nice to hear. It's nice to hear you're doing great.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you're doing great, but there's this one thing over here. Maybe on the next one, work on that. Because no one's done a perfect broadcast. No one's gone through a show, particularly, you know, a six-hour broadcast and hit every nail on the head. So there's always room to grow. So, yeah, you've done great is not always helpful. Let's talk about how you prep for a fight. We talk about the traffic and stuff. There's a lot of elements that go into a broadcast, but let's break it down into the fight for the moment. When you're preparing for a fight, what are the elements? For myself, for example, during the walkout, I'm trying to tell a backstory, trying to set the scene for everyone who's watching at home. The story. This is WWE, so it's a lot of narrative-driven stuff. And then there's certain stuff that I'll have inside the match I'm trying to get across. How does it work for you with the UFC fight?
Pretty similar. I think the walkout for me is a time where you can really dive into the story or the narrative of the moment. I'm very invested in the walkout. So, yes, and if that doesn't go well, I don't feel like the table's been set particularly nicely and I get aggravated by that. That's something that annoys me. So then we have that. Then there's the general setups with the tail of the tape and a couple of other bits. And then you've got to tick off the box with your trunks and blah, 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 time clock, sponsors. And then you have to fight. And this is where it's hard. This is the real skill and challenge of commentary. And you can't get it right every time. As you said, the perfect broadcast probably doesn't exist, much like the perfect fight for one of the athletes doesn't exist. But you have to then get a balance between exploring some narratives and telling a bit of the story or backstory of an individual, what's going on in the fight, bringing in some analysis, educating the new fans, and just finding the peaks and flows where you can put that in rather than trying to jam stuff in just because you want to get it out. And I've been guilty of that. And sometimes I think I'll get away with it because there'll be a bit more time in the fight and then there hasn't been. And you're halfway down a story about grandma and a book that they gave the fighter when they were six and then they've just got head kick knocked and you're like, ah, oh, that couldn't have happened at a worse time. So, yeah, there's just over. Like, I see people overly telling me stats, and I'm like, it's not even the right time to be talking about a stat. So I'm trying to find the optimal time for certain bits of information that has to be relevant and feel natural within the fight. And be balanced with that. So you've got all of those, but then you don't want to lean too heavily into fighter X because fighter Y needs to be spoken about as well. Otherwise, you've gone in hard on X, but Y is the one who's just succeeded with the moment of their life and no one knows anything about them still or what's gone on in this camp. So it's hard. And when you've got two other broadcasters with you, because now it's normally a three-man booth, and these guys, they're alpha males that can, you know, they run a little bit with these things. By the time you get the baton back, it's like, right, I'm not sure we've served it as well as we could. Let's try and do better for the next one. But you don't get that chat. That's like an internal monologue.
How closely do you work with your broadcast partners? And how do you prefer a two-man booth or the three-man booth?
So in terms of how closely, when I was working with Dan Hardy, because we did so much other stuff, We did a couple of shows together outside of our commentary work. We'd be on the road traveling from London to wherever. So we'd talk about this stuff a lot more. We'd train a little bit. He'd like coach me and be very kind to me in that way. So we spent a lot of time around one another when it came to UFC fight weeks. So yeah, there was a lot more conversation. Now I've not been back really. I've only called one fight in over a year. And so Paul Felder is someone that I do have some chats with. We'll hang out as well, but not so much Bisping. He hasn't been around as long and we haven't done much together in this region. So as much as I talk to those guys, it's not all work focused. I actually have a really good relationship with Brendan and John Anik. So we talk about stuff sometimes and I might be on location when John Anik is calling a fight. I might be on the desk or reporting something like that. So we sometimes exchange information. Kind of works a little bit like that. The two-man, three-man booth. Two-man allows me more space on the mic. And I really enjoyed my time with Dan. When we brought Paul in, I was a little nervous, but we had a lot of fun. And then I had two badass fighters and broadcasters to challenge and bring their opinions out. And Paul would know the Americans much better than what we would. And like the scene, Dan would know everything that's going on in Europe and that high level stuff from going all the way back to Pride. I can tap into more stuff if we've got another two sitting next to me. But sometimes I feel like the structure of what commentary should look like starts to fray and we're not all taking the roles that we should. And because we all want to now speak, those roles are mixing up and we have to sort of get back down and rejig for the next fight. But it's, yeah, there are some challenges to both. Talking way more over 7 hours brings its own challenges. So it's kind of nice to share the load. But I must say, it's whatever the fans want, right? And I think the fans get more value out of three than they do out of two. But maybe I'll get in trouble for this. Sometimes I feel like, why are we bringing in six or seven voices? Like, there's so many voices sometimes. I'm like, well, these guys do such a good job, but now we're not giving them the time to flex because we've got to try and get to other people. Mm. So, but the UFC, for example, they know how to do this better than I ever will. They've done this for so long and they've tried everything. So my difference of opinion is probably wrong because they have very clever people that have designed this whole thing.
You've caught so many great fights. Is there one that stands out in your mind that you're proud to be the soundtrack for?
Probably not. Anna could have done a good job, or Brendan's voice would have sounded nice over that. I have a real affinity with the sport, so it's hard for me to like single out these things. And I have a terrible, terrible memory. I genuinely do. I go on the things that feel good and the places. And I really love going to Australia. It's very special for me to go to Australia and cool fights down there. Then there was the whole rise of Conor McGregor and being a part of that through Cage Warriors. And those fights get played out so much, it's hard for me not to notice. I'll get tagged in them. I'll hear my own voice. And you're like, shit, I was part of something there. And then 2014, Conor McGregor headlining Dublin. I was there on the mic for that. And it was bonkers. But then there are other moments where we've been out to Russia and the very last event they ever did in the Olympic Stadium. And it stank of cat's piss. And it was massive. And we had a load of crazy Russians going mental. And it was just a great night, just the magnitude of it. And it was all very authentic and quite challenging, but we overcame. And I like those nights as well. There's been some in between. Gustafsson at the Globe, when he knocked out Teixeira with one of the most beautiful combinations, but then followed it up by proposing to his girlfriend in the middle of the octagon. It's like, this night can't get any better in terms of a TV type deal. And I was there trying to celebrate this beautiful violence and then bring it down into this very beautiful moment between two loving people. Like, that's crazy, right? So, yeah, I've been lucky to have those moments, and I really hope I get to, you know, have a lot more.
Yeah, look, for me as a fan of your work, it's those moments that will live forever. I mean, the rise of Connor is one that stands out. You are the soundtrack to so many of those moments. When people look back at his legacy, it's your voice calling that. That's got to feel pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. And at the time, I still don't really think of it like that. It's not about me, but it's nice to be part of something. As we get older, mate, and I know that you're a father now, community is a very, very important thing. They talk about it takes a village to raise a child and all of these cliches, but they're very true. And they're steeped in philosophies and stuff like that. And if you don't have a group of people that you feel connected to in your time on this planet, then it's just not going to be the best human experience. And for me, the MMA community and some of the, like, I'm in the triathlon world as well, like being part of something like that is so wonderful. And to feel like I might have added some value along the way and helped, that means something more than the paycheck at the end of it or any kudos. It's just being there and looking around and seeing those faces and seeing, like, we get these small, like, incremental benefits to the wider MMA sport. Yeah, it's very cool, man. It's very cool. And hopefully I'll be an OG one day and still be involved in this crazy thing. I'm sure I will. I'm already calling fights for people that I could have fathered. So, which is worrying, right? I still don't really consider myself the age that I am, but it's the, you know, father time is cruel.
Mate, you're holding up well. But just going back to one of your points, I think it's that thing where, you know, I know I love sport. I used to play a lot of sport and I love the adrenaline rush it gave me. And I think part of the reason I love what I get to do now is because you get to give some of that rush to the people at home. You know, we all watch sport because we want to live vicariously in some way through that moment. And being able to provide that soundtrack is, you know, if you watch a fight without commentary, it could be great. But when you put great commentary on it, it elevates it all in the experience of watching that. I love going to watch sport live, but I also equally, sometimes more, love watching it at home because you get that narrative soundtrack with it. And when it's done well, it's so amazing. Do you have the same feeling that you're getting to accentuate these moments for these athletes and the viewers at home?
When I sit down and start thinking about the events, then it's the colours and the tones that you're trying to enrich using the crowd as another instrument in the whole process, telling the story, helping that individual. What are the UFC trying to achieve? What's significant about London? Like, I'll be frank with you, mate. I honestly think I'm going to cry at this London event. It's been so long. We've had it pulled away from us a couple of times. Personally, it's been professionally a bit of a shit time. And I'm now on a home gig where I know all the fighters I get messages off of UFC fighters locally going, do you know anything yet? Are we on? It means so much. And the fans are always on at you. Like, are we there? I'm like, I really hope so. And I think once I get through that broadcast, it's going to be a real moment. And I don't know how I'm going to be able to do that on air without maybe getting a bit choked up. Because there are times where you're looking at this pandemic in the height of the fear going, what is going to come of our sport? We are the worst. We are sweating and bleeding into one another's mouths, let alone breathing. It's like, this is not great for us. So,
I went to Bellator's London show. It was October time, and it was their first show with fans. The first show with fans. Mental. And I can tell you what, the atmosphere in there, I haven't felt anything like that in a long, long time. Everyone was so happy to be there. I was also doing Bellator's show in Milan the year before that, the empty arena shows. And that was bizarre in itself. And, you know, going back to your point, like, what's happening to this sport? This is a sport, as you say, where this COVID could really affect it in all these ways. So that was surreal in itself. And then fast forward nearly a year to be in London watching Bellator and have that kind of atmosphere, it makes you realise why we love this. And now I'm excited for you. For that London card, you know, as you say, the atmosphere there, the emotions there. Because UFC is just a different beast. It crosses borders. You know, there's a lot of people who don't follow MMA who follow UFC. Yeah. There's a lot of people that will come into that mix. And yeah, that's going to be a, that's going to be so, so special.
Yeah, I was at the Arsenal game, Arsenal-Tottenham, and I could talk about this as an Arsenal fan, and it was just before the Bellator show, and I'd gone back-to-back with these events, and the Arsenal, even though it was a derby, obviously there's a good atmosphere, but I've never felt the crowd like it at the Emirates, from before the kickoff, walking up, buying a drink, the whole thing. I'm like, oh, people are so ready for this. And we're not the greatest fans in the world, Arsenal fans. I might get a little bit of hate for saying that, but let's be honest, you know. But it was just brilliant. And I felt that at Bellator as well. And I now want that for the UFC, for the guys that are coming over from the States and the athletes, the international athletes, but I want that, of course, for all of us guys in the UK, the fans in the UK and Europe that are coming over to experience it. We've missed it. And it's just going to be bonkers. And it's going to bring out the best in the fighters, for sure. It will change the way they fight. I know it will.
Well, look, I hope it does happen in March. I hope it's your voice giving us that soundtrack. And as I said, I think that's going to be a very special event. After everything everyone around the world's gone through, but let's drive down into the MMA community. That is going to be a very, very special night. Look, John, thank you for this chat. It's great to get into your head, your approach to commentary, seeing how you got here. A real pleasure to talk to you, and I can't wait to hear you calling fights very soon.
Thanks, dude. It's good to talk about this stuff with someone that understands it, right? Like, we're in a privileged position. It's nice to be able to share it. Sounds like we're moaning about certain... Well, I was the one moaning about a couple of things, but... Yeah, I think people underestimate what goes into some of this, but it's what makes the job so much more appealing for me. If it was easy and you could be blasé about it, I'm not sure that it would drive me the way that it does. The sleepless nights, the tears, the joy, you know, this stuff is a job with a real importance. If we're getting it wrong, if we're telling people how to score fights wrong, if we're saying that referee's an idiot, that poor referee's all of a sudden going to wake up to an awful lot of hate. And yeah, we have to take the job seriously. And I know we both do. And yeah, it's the best job in the world.
Well, John, can't wait to see what 2022 holds for you, my friend.
Appreciate it, mate. You too as well. Catch up with you soon.